From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with the headline. On May 21st, the New York Times opened its morning newsletter with the question, has fentanyl peaked? The headline was followed by an explanation for a decline in overdose deaths. The report came after the CDC released preliminary data on opioid overdose deaths for 2023. According to that data, the number of deaths declined for the first time in 5 years. The drop was nearly 4%. The New York Times piece pointed to two main reasons: what it called the faddish cycle of drug epidemics and increased access to addiction treatment and medications like Narcan that can reverse opioid overdoses. The newsletter read, quote, while the opioid crisis has taken some surprising and terrible twists over the years, it may finally be turning around, end quote. And that is good news, right? While some experts say the trend downward could continue, others who work in the field are concerned that this news could make people complacent about the crisis. They say the epidemic is still out of control. One of our guests this hour described the New York Times newsletter piece as a, quote, ridiculously stupid, simplistic article that may lead some to think we should stop worrying. It's important to emphasize that the CDC data is preliminary and that it represents a national look at the issue. Different communities across the country have had varying levels of success or not navigating the opioid epidemic. And as the Times did report, annual overdose deaths remain above 100,000. That's higher than the annual death toll from car crashes and guns combined. This hour, we discuss the state of the crisis, both locally and nationally. Our guests help us understand the data, what it means for communities like ours, what approaches have and haven't worked, and what needs to happen next. And as we will also talk about, it is a very large number of Americans who have been touched by this crisis in some way, and I know for many people this is personal. Let me welcome our guests now. Jennifer Farringer in studio with us is director of DePaul's National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence for the Rochester area. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Robert Kent is with us on the line, president of Kent Strategic Advisors, LLC, former general counsel for the White House, a national drug control policy. Robert, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Evan, for having me.
Robert, I'm going to start with you just because I think you might have been the first person we heard from when the New York Times piece came out. And I admit, when I first saw the headlines, I was buoyed by this sense of, wow, maybe we've crested this wave and inevitably it's going to come down steeply. And you were warning against that. So take us through your concerns with, in particular, this idea that we may be finally turning this thing around.
Well, so first off, it's 1 year. It's a projection. It most likely won't turn out to be the case, but it's just so damaging because there's already, I get the sense, working on this stuff, you know, with folks in New York and then just nationally, there's a malaise. People are worn out. I don't know what it is, but this certainly didn't help. And, you know, to be honest, what the data is also showing that this reporter, I guess, didn't have the time to write in his little article there, deaths with fentanyl are increasing significantly in communities of color. So while they might have gone down, and to be honest, the statisticians I worked with in the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, when you see a trend line for years, that's it. It's a trend line. Other than that, it might be an anomaly. It might be the beginnings. It might not be. And so it's just so damaging. And it was really unthought out. So I mentioned that there's huge increases now in communities of color. But beyond that, the nature of the drug supply is changing too. It's you have folks who are actively knowingly seeking out fentanyl, because there really is no heroin on the street at this point. It is fentanyl. But now the cartels are, you know, pressing it into fake pills. And when I say fake pills, I mean like fake Ritalin, Adderall, Xanax, OxyContin. And then it's being mixed into other drugs, stimulants, methamphetamine, cocaine. And so I just felt like it just wasn't well thought out. They didn't talk to anybody, or at least if they did, they didn't quote them. And it's just such a simplistic thing to do and a damaging thing to do, in my opinion.
I'm not going to read the whole piece, which would probably make Robert go crazy on the air here. I am going to read just
when I'll take credit for the quote, the comment that you, it was mine.
That was your quote. Let me read one other section of that, Robert, and then I'll turn to Jennifer as well here. But this is, I think, where some readers who don't have a whole lot of history, facility with understanding drug trends, they're going to read this and they're going to feel that optimism that I talked about. So I'm going to quote, and then I want you to take us through your response here. The Times writes, quote, "Drugs are often faddish. Epidemics tend to ebb on their own. Why? Users die. People see the damage that a drug does and they shun it. Surviving users move on to other drugs that they see as better or safer, sometimes incorrectly. The opioid epidemic has arguably been a succession of three different fads. First, opioid painkillers, then heroin, and finally fentanyl, that have felt like one. Opioids, including fentanyl, have already reached every corner of the country. They have few places left to spread. The COVID pandemic is over, taking with it the chaos and isolation that led to more overdoses. The drug users most likely to die have already done so. More people have rejected opioid use, and the remaining users have learned how to use fentanyl more safely." End quote. Robert Kent, can you respond first to some of what you just heard there?
Well, the notion that drug use is quote unquote faddish is so ignorant, it's unworthy almost of a response. But, you know, people use drugs because they're in pain. They've got, you know, reasons why they use. Those aren't faddish. And to the families who've lost loved ones and have loved ones who are currently using, there's nothing faddish about that. And so, you know, there's been, and this is what generates some of my anger as well. The system, the addiction care system, has been disrespected, underfunded, underappreciated for decades. And so things like this make people think like, well, they've done their job, mission accomplished, we can move on. And no, we need to double down. The drugs are changing, as I mentioned. The people being impacted haven't died. And, you know, to think that it's a fad that people use a drug that, you know, will kill them is ridiculously simplistic.
Jennifer, you want to add to that?
I couldn't agree more with Rob. It's an insulting article, really. The addiction is a disease of the brain. It's not a whim, it's not a fancy, and it's not a fad. So, yeah, there's so many ways that this is disrespecting the community, those that are in the throes of addiction, certainly the family members who are dealing with the chaos of addiction and the loss of a loved one, and particularly as well that SUD, the substance use disorder field, prevention, treatment, and recovery, who are working hard on this issue, continue to work with minimal resources and funding.
And is that, Jennifer, is that part of the concern here that a piece like this, or just a mindset like this, if it spreads, the assumption that, well, we've crested the wave, we're on the way down, does that jeopardize funding, prioritization, research, efforts at prevention?
Oh, for sure. At prevention, always. We're kind of the stepchild of this system, so last to be funded. The entire issue around opioid epidemic or any epidemic is very reaction focused. I mean, it's a crisis. So obviously you want to put your resources on the back end. You want to prevent further deaths. You want to make sure people get access to treatment, which honestly could be better in terms of funding. You want to be sure they have access to recovery resources. But we always forget about the front end. And there is not a disease reaction that's been successful without a significant impact or funding of prevention on the front end, working with kids and families before there's addiction, before they fall into the rapid, so to speak, reducing harm before it even happens.
Can I ask both of you then? I'll start with you, Robert. What do you think? I guess I should start with this. The numbers are preliminary, and the final picture of 2023, I understand, could change. But let's just for a moment assume that we've got a slight downtick in opioid deaths, overdose deaths, in 2023 for the first time in a number of years. What do you think accounts for even a small the word improvement is a hard word for me to use here when 100,000 people have died, and I'm not trying to use it lightly, but I'm just looking at purely statistical terms. What do you think accounts for that change, Robert?
And I know this from my work when I was at New York Oasis, that when we saw a decline in like 2017, 2018, I would, begrudgingly acknowledge, because we weren't responsible for this at Oasis, DOH was, but we've significantly expanded access to naloxone. And I think that probably, plays a role. I mean, because so even if you like just look at numbers, right, a 3% reduction of 100,000 people is a couple thousand people, a few thousand people. And the other thing too is any government official who's like pounding their chest or taking a victory lap, we should show them a new line of work, because anybody who thinks 100,000 people dying a year from one thing is acceptable. I don't find that acceptable. And any government official who does ought to not be working on this issue.
Jennifer, what would you say about where the numbers currently are?
Where they are in terms of...
I mean, is there any reason to think that at least, whether it's Narcan or otherwise, that some, again, improvement, is, I use that very gingerly here, but some improvement is due to some of those efforts?
Yeah, certainly increased access to Narcan. Originally, Narcan was available to EMS, right? That really was the system it was issued. Now it's broadly accessible. It needs to be more broadly accessible. So we do everything we can on our end, on the prevention end, to promote the use, the training, have it at your side. If you're with loved ones, friends, family circle who uses drug, if you're anyone, because of the prevalence, it's important that everyone be Narcan trained. So yes, the increase of availability and access to Narcan, but also the increase of medication-assisted treatment. And that would be in the treatment side of the house. So various medications that assist someone.
Okay. And part of what we're going to talk about for the rest of this hour is I think our guests have the expertise to tell us what they see happening that they think is moving in the right direction, what policies or approaches still need more emphasis or a try. I mean, Robert's got an 11-point plan. We're going to talk through a lot of specifics coming up here. Can I also ask you, Robert, though, when you look at the legislative session that just passed here in New York State, and you think about, dealing with drug and alcohol death, I mean, alcohol is a drug, of course, but, if we're going to put it that way, what do you see in the legislative session that indicates where the priority is?
Not on this issue. All due respect. I mean, in fact, they passed legislation that will potentially make it easier for people to access alcohol. So
I think that's the bill allowing direct shipment of alcohol to people's homes.
Yeah. Now, I know it's limited. It's not full open. But, these companies are in it to make money and sell their product. And if we learned anything in COVID, huge spike in alcoholism. And just so your listeners understand, alcohol-related deaths are more than opioids. It's about 178,000 a year, according to national agencies. So, that's the response. And, opioid settlement funds still sit in the bank, unspent. We don't know where they're at. There's an opioid tax. Nobody knows how much has come in. Nobody knows how much is going out to where. So there are resources available, but they don't seem to be getting into the hands of people like Jennifer who can actually make things happen. And I say this having worked in this space for almost 20 years now, this system knows how to stretch the dollar unlike any other system. So the money being out there is critical, and I don't think it's getting out there. And the single biggest issue in this system is a complete inability to recruit and retain workers. So nobody's working at their full approved license certified capacity, because again, hire the people to do the work. So Where's the workforce plan with the hundreds of millions of dollars that have come in to the state of New York? You know, and the government cleverly says, we've made all of our funds available. That's like the check might be in the mail. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It certainly is not in the hands or the bank accounts of people like Jennifer.
Mm-hmm. You want to add to that, Jennifer?
Absolutely. So in terms of COLA, workforce was our primary issue, and that's across prevention, treatment, and recovery. We were asking for potentially an 8% COLA cost of living. What we ended up getting at 2.4 with some restrictions as to who that could apply to. We have not recovered since COVID. There's an enormous workforce crisis. I've been in the field 35 years now. I have never seen a situation in our field where you could post a position and have it open for months, if not longer.
And not fill it.
Either getting people applying that it appears they're just checking a box because they have absolutely no qualifications for the position opening. It doesn't even look like they read the position that's opening. Or are people ghosting you? You know, you go through applications, you set up interviews, and then no shows. It's a very peculiar environment and workforce crisis. And that's for us across the board. Treatment is suffering for low staffing. We're suffering for low staffing. We're at the lowest we've been.
Do you need to pay people more to attract better workers?
So all of the above. One, attraction into the field. How do you do that? By paying more, by benefits. Retention, once you have them, how do you keep them? Again, paying more and benefits. And we ask OASIS, our primary funder in New York State, you know, hear us when our budgets in many cases have been flatlined with little opportunities to do maybe respond to small RFPs, response for proposals that fund the next shiny penny, the next new program. Assume that you can hire a staff for a minimal 1 year or less to do XYZ, when obviously it takes more than a year to get someone on board in doing that program. So it's almost like dropping in the bucket when we need much more in terms of support.
And can I ask you, Jennifer and Robert, about just, you know, Robert mentioned, for example, the legislature deciding that they're going to allow direct shipments of alcohol to people's homes. Again, there's some limitations there. But let me ask you just on libertarian grounds and on policy grounds, you know, maybe what you'd like to see here. I mean, our guests point out that the number of alcohol deaths is higher than opioid overdose. I mean, I think the number that Robert gave was 178,000 to around 100,000. And I'm someone who's fortunate that, I mean, I've never in my life felt like I have to have a drink today. I feel very fortunate that it is, I could have a half of a drink, I could have a drink, I could have nothing for days. It doesn't affect me in that way. And yet I've seen alcoholism close to me. And it's, when you see it, it's very, it can be devastating, of course. It could end someone's life. It can destroy families. So for New Yorkers who say, look, let us decide and let us work through it and let us work through, you know, decisions that we want to make, or even alcoholism is a medical problem, but don't deny us the right to have alcohol shipped to our homes. What do you say to that, Jennifer? Mm-hmm. What do you want the policy of the law to be?
So as a preventionist, we always look at access and availability. During COVID, we saw the very, very sharp increase in alcoholism due to increased access. You could walk into a restaurant and you could get a mixed drink to go, right? And this is sort of a continuation of the policy. So it's a continuation of the relaxation of the access policy. This is but one. So I'd be in favor of keeping it less accessible for those that have an issue. I mean, the other thing, too, you have it shipped to your home. What about access to kids, to young people? That increases. So I agree. There are those who can socially drink, quote unquote, who have no issue. This would be a problem for them. But what about those that are impacted hugely, that fall into addiction, fall into alcoholism? It's devastating. When you look at the Monroe County Medical Examiner report, and I know I shared with you, Evan, the most recent, and they look at number one cause of death for folks that they've gone through the toxicology screen for, fentanyl, no surprises at the top. but we forget about cocaine and alcohol, which are number two and number three in terms of death. And we forget about that. And we've seen, as you track the ME reports, and this is but one, it's produced annually, you can see alcohol moving up and up and up on that chart, and particularly during the COVID time period when accessibility was increased hugely.
Robert Kent, what would you say about the idea that some New Yorkers might say, hey, allow these direct shipments, let us decide?
Okay, well then let's make some investments in the work that Jennifer does. Prevention. I understand it's a legal substance, but what kind of messages are we putting out there in any significant way to talk about using it, you know, responsibly? And what are we talking about young folks, about the, you know, I mean, look, I was a kid, I have two 20-somethings, you know, telling them not to do something was the same as telling me they're going to do it. But so talk about consequences. And I, you know, and I'll say it, I mean, that with the hundreds of millions of dollars coming in so far to New York State and opioid settlement funds, there's been no major investment in front-end prevention, or for that matter, back-end recovery supports and services. So, you know, there's a healthy treatment network out there. They don't have the ability to operate fully at this point, but the infrastructure exists. They can't find the people. So, I get it, you know. It would have been much better if they balanced that out by, you know, enacting other legislation. For instance, you know, everyone interchanges the term Narcan, which is one product or version of naloxone. There's multiple versions of naloxone approved by the FDA, different modes of administration, different dosage levels. And, you know, talk to folks on the ground who are reversing overdoses. The one product that New York State makes available, because they refuse to make them all available, they're using up 4 or 5 boxes of Narcan. That's 8 milligrams a box. And there's higher dosed ones. It mystifies me to no end doing this work, you know, New York, you know, nationally, that, you know, like we're the one disease space where we tie our own hands behind our back. We don't need anybody to do it for us. We do our own harm to ourselves, and we fight each other about harm reduction and treatment and et cetera. But, you know, it would have been nice if other legislative initiatives had been put forward.
One other point before we kind of continue to work through possible changes in how our state, our society deals with opioids and addiction. Again, going back to the beginning here, the reason that we were here in the first place is because there was a lot of media, I'll use the word hype, about a preliminary and small downturn in opioid overdose deaths, leading to a May New York Times headline that said, "Has fentanyl peaked?" Our guests are saying, be very, very careful. Don't overstate what you think is some sort of a cycle or a trend. That ignores history. And on top of that, you know, the numbers are probably not going down. So, I mean, I'm not going to ask you to kind of predict. Let me just put it this way. I'll start with Jennifer. When it comes to fentanyl, opioid overdose, et cetera, do you think that once we finally, when we end up having 2024 numbers and 2025 numbers, would it be your expectation that the numbers will see a decline? Or do you think it is more likely, based on everything you're seeing, that they will continue to rise from where they are?
If I had to predict, I would say stay at the same level or rise. That would be my prediction.
And they're at a horrifying level to begin with.
They are. So even if they go down slightly, as the article points to, and as we know, over 100,000 deaths is not acceptable, right? So when you look at the increased activity of the cartels, the major cartels coming out of Mexico, they're doing very well. There's cartel presence in every state in New York. So fentanyl is easy trafficable, easy to add. As Rob was pointing out, one of our biggest fears with prevention is adding it into so-called fake pills or look-alike drugs. There's a wonderful website on DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration, and their campaign is One Pill Can Kill. If someone comes across one of these pills, whether it's Xanax, Percocet, or whatever, and it could be almost anything, you cannot, no one, not even an expert or toxicologist, can tell the difference unless that pill is analyzed in the laboratory. So these are sophisticated pill pressers that the cartels have access to. And look at how well they're doing. It doesn't show any decline. Are we making inroads? Absolutely. Should we be doing more? Absolutely. But we need to the support to do more across the board, prevention, treatment, and recovery.
Robert Kent, agree?
Absolutely.
That was easy. That was the shortest answer of the hour.
I'm always going to agree with Jennifer.
Robert is the president of Kent Strategic Advisors, LLC, and former general counsel for the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Jennifer Farringer is with me in studio, the director of DePaul's National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence for the Rochester area. I've got a question from a listener about fentanyl. And which we're going to get to after we take our only break of the hour. I will invite more comments or questions if you have them as we talk about understanding where we are with fentanyl, with an opioid overdose crisis, with numbers that are in still six-figure deaths a year. And unfortunately, that runs counter to some of the headlines that came out about a month ago, kind of heralding that maybe the wave has crested and that we are on the downside. And unfortunately, our guests who have decades of work in this field are telling us, we got to pump the brakes on that. There's a lot that has to be done. And there's a lot of people still dying and very much at risk. So we'll come back. We'll take some of your calls, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I know this is a very personal it's a very personal issue for a lot of families, a lot of New Yorkers. There are really tough numbers when you see, and I'll pull them up here in a moment here, just how, oh, here they are from the Times Union. 68% of New Yorkers say they have been impacted in some way by opioid abuse, including knowing someone who has abused opioids or died from an overdose. That is a sharp increase from just 4 years ago. 68%, more than two out of three New Yorkers, have been personally affected in some way. It doesn't have to be themselves, someone they know, someone they love, a friend, a family member. I mean, that is a huge number of people. And if you want to make a comment or ask a question, it's easier to do it. You can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. Let's get that break. We'll come right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Dr. Steve Cook joins us in studio. He joins us to talk about the growing trend of prescribing Wegovy or Ozempic for teenagers, for weight loss. Now, it's not the main treatment for obesity or other diseases for kids, but it's a growing option that doctors are using. We're going to talk to Dr. Cook about the implications next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It seems to me like every few months I see a different sort of headline about how drugs are being cut, and I say cut, I mean fentanyl added to different drugs. I mean, it's why our guests, the idea of one pill can kill, you hear horrible stories about, a teenager who thinks they took Percocet at a party. It's cut or laced with fentanyl or other things. I mean, these tragedies are becoming more and more commonplace. And one of the drugs that I first heard about a number of years back, and that now I'm seeing like these varying headlines on animal tranquilizers, and xylazine is one example that we've heard. Mm-hmm. But Jennifer Farringer, let me start with you here. I know there's an important message you want the community to understand about xylazine in particular.
Yeah, it's huge. And by the way, our fact sheets can be downloaded from our website on xylazine and fentanyl. But xylazine, there's been a lot of mixed or myths out in the community that because it's not an opioid, and it is not, it's a tranquilizer, you don't need to use Narcan. Bad messaging. because it's being cut into a product that's likely already high percentage, if not all, fentanyl. And then adding the tranq or the xylazine, it exacerbates the respiratory distress from the fentanyl. So now you've got two drugs kind of depressing respiration. The Narcan or naloxone will act against the fentanyl. It won't act against the xylazine, but at least you've done something in response to the fentanyl. You've also hopefully called first 911. So you get EMS coming. They have more naloxone on board. They transport to the hospital. They have more naloxone on board where they can then treat the symptoms around xylazine.
Do you want to add to that, Robert Kent?
Yeah, so in April of 23, right as I was leaving the Office of National Drug Control Policy, our director issued a national alert, an emerging drug threat that was a concern about fentanyl being adulterated with xylazine. Just for your listeners, xylazine's an animal tranquilizer. It has no approved human use. We were seeing it show up in too many parts of the country to not be concerned. And in fact, the areas that we weren't seeing it was most likely because it wasn't being tested for. It extends the length of the high from the fentanyl. So people understand why would somebody use this? And one of the things we also noticed was, at this point, most people who are using street drugs know that it's fentanyl, right? But none of them, or very few at least, leading up to this time, knew that xylazine was mixed in to the drug. And absolutely agree with Jennifer, you have to use naloxone to reverse the overdose from the opioid, to get the person breathing again. So that's critical. There's a new animal tranquilizer I'm hearing about. I don't even know how to pronounce it.
Medetomidine.
Yes.
Let me go ahead and read this. This comes from the New York State Department of Health. Yeah. The New York State Department of Health issued a public health alert after the department's drug checking program community partners, ACR Health and Catholic Charities, detected a dangerous mix of substances in central New York. The programs identified two samples and the laboratory confirmed that they contained medetomidine, a high-potency synthetic sedative used in veterinary medicine that is more potent in the central nervous system than xylazine. Mm-hmm. Medetomidine, I think, is how I would say it. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, well, but just so you know, so here we are, we're talking about like these incredible, if they don't sound good, they aren't. And so we're saying victory here, or we don't need to worry as much. You're talking right now about how, dynamic the drug system is and the products on the street. Look, the cartels, if nothing else, I don't like what they do. They're very smart business people. They know their customers. They're always doing things to try to create new customers. So just so folks understand as well, with xylazine, you develop or can develop horrific wounds on the skin, and you don't need to be injecting it to develop the wounds. And they don't necessarily, even if you are injecting it, occur at the injection site. Mm-hmm. So you're now adding in serious potential infections on top of an opioid addiction. So, all the more reason for us to be doubling down on our vigilance.
Let me read some listener feedback, and there's quite an array here. Tim starts with the question, is this a border control issue with fentanyl? Robert Kent?
Oh, I love this. I love this question. So is it a border issue? Yes, but let's get some facts out there. So the migrants there's far fewer now coming across the border, they're not smuggling fentanyl across the border. It's Americans who bring it across the border. And just for your listeners to have some context, border crossings at the southern border in a year, there's probably 1.5 million. So there's been proposals in Washington to increase funding to hire more agents, but also to invest in screening technology. They have not made it through this Congress. And then one other thing that people ought to remember, most of it, I would say, or a good chunk of it, comes through the parcel carrier systems. And they probably check less than 1% of packages from states and countries we know are marketing in these products in a week. So we're up against it, but the mythology that it's somehow a border issue, it's a border issue because Americans keep crossing the border to bring it back into America. It's not the migrants.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer?
I absolutely agree. It's totally not a migrant issue. But when you think of fentanyl, think of what it is. A tiny top of a pen is about all you need for a fatal overdose. That makes it very transportable. So it goes through the mail, through the post. It goes added to other products that may be labeled as one thing, but either the fentanyl and or maybe the xylazine is integrated in the mislabeled product, so it can go over by trucks. Again, these are not migrants carrying it across the board. These are business people. These are the cartels that have a sophisticated system of transporting drugs into our country over a variety of means, through ports, seaports. And again, the cartels have a presence in every state in the United States.
Dell writes to us to say, and he's worked as a public defender and as a defense attorney. He says, I've lost more clients to opioid addiction than I care to count over the years. I agree with the panelists that unfortunately, I've not seen a curb in this trend even anecdotally. I am, however, heartened by the increased focus on harm reduction as opposed to vilification of those who are in the throes of addiction and an increased desire to understand these issues instead of criminalize them all away. I think we've still got a long way to go, but it is helpful to see a public who wants to understand and educate rather than penalize and promote untenable just-say-no platitudes. Mm-hmm. So thank you, speakers, for all you do. That is from mm-hmm. Dell in Ontario County. Robert Kent, do you want to start with the question of harm reduction and some of Dell's points there?
He's spot on. Mm-hmm. So, look, I've been doing this work. Jennifer's been doing this work because we love this work. It's meaningful. It enriches our lives. Do I like that people use drugs? Absolutely not. Do I acknowledge they will? And we can either try to engage them and embrace them and love them up, or we can dismiss them. And nowadays, when we dismiss them, they die. And so I don't like people dying. I care too much about other human beings. I wasn't raised that way. So we, and just think about it from your own life, right? People telling you what you need to do to get better doesn't work with me. I usually like to make up my own mind. It doesn't work with people who use drugs. So harm reduction is meeting people where they're at. It's offering them safety. It's offering them love, you know, healthcare, social needs, whatever we need to do to stop people from dying. I'm all for it. And harm reduction is one of those things.
Jennifer?
There's an expression that I love. Meet people where they're at. Don't leave them where they're at. So that, I think, goes beyond or takes maybe harm reduction to reducing harm. So I would suggest that we're reducing harm at all levels, just different places in the stream, so to speak. You know, prevention, we're before someone jumps in. Treatment, you're in the throes of the rapids. Recovery, you're trying to climb out of the stream. So there's so many ways we can reduce harm. We need to, again, add to those resources, not to detract from them.
Alex writes to say, Evan, I'm having deja vu to when you covered this topic 5 years ago. There was a panelist who spoke about the damage to the psyche and the soul in the early years of the heroin epidemic and the nascent war on drugs impacting Black communities in particular. Addiction doesn't just happen. It happens because people are at risk. Those in pain and facing hopelessness are most at risk. Mm-hmm. Current drug policy is firefighting when it should be treated as forestry management. Mm-hmm. At a time when more and more wealth is concentrated upwards into fewer and fewer hands, I just don't see how we solve this crisis without addressing the true root cause. That is from Alex. Jennifer Farringer, mm-hmm. do you want to start with a response there?
Alex, beautifully stated. Couldn't agree with you more. We've got to get to the root. And what we have seen in terms of trends, if we're talking about this crisis right now, the opioid fentanyl crisis, in the beginning, when you looked at racial ethnicity, you saw more white males. It has shifted dramatically now to affecting more the black and brown community. What's the issue? The issue is more at risk. You know, are we putting equal access and access to resources as much, focusing as much on our black and brown sisters and brothers? Are we addressing issues of poverty, issues of accessing food deserts, access to medical care? I could go on and on, but I couldn't agree with you more, Alex.
You want to add to that, Robert Kent?
Yeah, I would add to what Alex has said is we have, you know, access now. So in New York State, you're going to have access to probably at the end of the day, $3 billion over the next decade and a half in opioid settlement funds. And are we investing them in a way that, you know, forest management, as Alex said, versus firefighting? And, you know, nationally, those settlements will end up being north of $50 billion. That's a huge amount of money in this system. And we need to make sure that it's invested in the right things. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I'll make a pitch for a workforce plan. I'll make a pitch for the front end work that Jennifer and her colleagues in the state do on prevention and back end recovery supports. I think those are amongst the things we need to make investments in over that decade and a half to ever get to a point where we're mitigating this to, I don't think we'll ever get, unfortunately, to an acceptable level, but that doesn't mean we can't and shouldn't fight to get there.
Prevention can mean different things. Prevention, of course, when it's really effective in our society, means people don't pursue drugs and don't become addicted. They don't feel hopelessness or nihilism. And there's a lot of very complicated things that go into that. And people more intelligent than me have spoken about that. And those are related and separate conversations we will continue to have. On the subject of prevention as well, there are the idea of, do we need more overdose prevention centers? And part of Robert's 11-point plan is saying that the governor needs to allow the Department of Health, the commissioner of the Department of Health, to authorize the study of overdose prevention centers statewide. Robert, what is an overdose prevention center? I think listeners have some ideas in their mind when they hear that. How does it function?
So there's two of them in New York City in Manhattan at this point. Authorized by the city of New York, ignored by the state of New York. And what happens is that is a place where people can go to deal with social needs, as simple as wash their clothes, take a shower, get a meal. And, you know, one of the things they will do is allow somebody to safely use their own drugs. Do I love it? No. But when we're losing 100,000 people a year and some people don't want to go get better, don't think they need to get better, don't have a problem, we need to be looking at every option. The one thing the evidence shows, because these facilities have existed in other countries, in Europe and Canada, for decades, nobody dies from overdose. Now, having said that, I really wish, you know, from a marketing perspective, they would identify what they do in a different way, because they're really comprehensive healthcare clinics, and they've got a little room off to the side where people will use their drugs, and because they're using them unsafely in the community. And so they do all these other things that get people better and ultimately get people in many instances convinced that now they're ready to go get help in the treatment system. So they work. The state could authorize them to happen. I get, you know, there's politics involved. I'm not a politician, so I don't necessarily care about that. But I know that when we're losing tens of thousands of people in New York State to drugs and alcohol, we need to be looking at everything we could do. And this is one other thing that we need to consider.
Jennifer, you've been part of task forces mm-hmm. that bring together people from a wide sort of variety of backgrounds. Sometimes it's law enforcement, government, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been disagreements that I have mm-hmm. heard in this community mm-hmm. about prevention centers, authorized use, et cetera. Where do you see that debate yourself?
Yeah, I have I guess I'm not as for it as Rob was stating. It's certainly been something that's been brought up several times at the Monroe County Opioid Task Force. And by the way, we're calling it Opioid and Other Drug Task Force now. We continue to meet. We represent all sectors. Of course, I have the word problems with them using the word opioid prevention because it assumes it's a prevention strategy. It's a death prevention, which is important. I just feel like there's better ways to go about it. You know, I know the recent experiment in Oregon, just for example, Oregon went the way of totally legalizing drugs. That didn't go very well. They've recently rescinded that. And why? They legalized all drugs without the understanding that you got to do more than that. You've got to support your system. They didn't support their system. So when people did want help, there was no place for people to go. It's almost like we're in that situation here. Let's put our resources into a system, infrastructure that's already there. It's underfunded, but it's already there, and support it fully. The entire range, prevention, treatment, recovery, reducing harm across the range, the continuum range, just reducing it in a variety of different ways.
So Robert, let me follow the point that Jennifer's raising about Oregon. There was a piece in the New York Times in April titled, "Oregon is Recriminalizing Drugs. Here's What Portland Learned." And Mayor Ted Wheeler of Portland told the New York Times that the experiment on legalization failed there. And he said a couple of things that I'd love to get your perspective on. And I don't claim to be an expert on Portland's laws or Oregon's laws, and I know that everything gets politicized. But I can tell you that the mayor and others who work in the field told the New York Times that a couple of things happened. With legalization, drugs became much more visible in a lot of places, a lot of public parks. People in the public who were not using drugs in larger numbers stopped going to the parks and avoided some public places. And then the idea of, well, when people need the help, they'll seek it, they'll get it, they'll have these supervised use. The experts in Oregon were telling the Times, it turns out that, you know, most people, when they are addicted, are not going to stand up and say, I need the help. I mean, like, they didn't see a lot of people doing that, and they didn't feel like that worked. So I wonder what you think of Oregon.
Well, I think with Oregon, they implemented a radical change without the infrastructure being in place to support it, mm-hmm. and not appreciating the fact that some folks didn't like the policy change and were never going to be supportive of it, and in fact would probably do things to not assist it coming to fruition. So, you know, I say all the time, having worked in policy and drug policy specifically for, you know, the last couple decades, you can have the best ideas in the world. If you don't have mechanics to make it happen, an implementation strategy, you don't think things through, then, you know, you screw up. And in this space, when you screw up there, you know, what you get is exactly what's happened. See, I told you it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So will it work? I don't know, but they didn't spend the time. They didn't get the resources necessary to do the work. It you know, if law enforcement's not going to be the intervention, are you putting people on the street to be the intervention? Right. And I don't think that really happened. And so, you know, sometimes you have to be careful about what you're trying to do. You know, I worked really hard on the things because I always knew, like, the stuff I've worked on nationally and in New York, some folks weren't happy with, didn't like, didn't agree with. So we always tried to make sure that we had the system in place, the mechanics in place to implement the policy and to make it work, and then to show the people who don't like it, we were right, get out of our way.
Yeah, here's what Mayor Wheeler told New York Times when they said, where do you think things most went wrong? He said, there's no question the state botched the implementation. The timing couldn't have been worse in terms of the botched implementation. To decriminalize the use of drugs before you actually had the treatment services in place was obviously a huge mistake. He says, with the benefit of hindsight, the way that should have been structured is that it would create the mechanism for funding. The state would build up its behavioral health services, and when it reached a certain threshold, then they would decriminalize drugs. We tried to do it the other way around. So I think
that's somebody who knows how to make policy.
Okay. So last minute and a half here. Jennifer Farringer, about 45 seconds. What do you want to leave with the audience here? As I mean, one of the big takeaways here is just be very careful with the hype that we've peaked with fentanyl, we've peaked with opioids, we're on the way down. That is unfortunately doesn't look to be the case. So what do you want to leave with listeners now?
So just that, not to be complacent. We've got a lot of work yet to do. We need to involve all parts of the system. And we also need to remember that there's other drugs responsible for overdoses, like cocaine, like alcohol, and other drugs. So it's not simply an opioid fentanyl issue, although that's right at the top of the list. There's other things that we've got to not forget.
Robert Kent.
Yeah, so that Siena study that you identified, you know, it asked two other questions that I took note of. Do you think the situation with opioids has improved, gotten worse, stayed about the same? 72% said it got worse. Do you think government's doing their job across, you know, all governmental entities in New York? 64% no, they're not doing as much as they can. So you are blessed in New York to have one of the most robust addiction care systems. It is the envy of almost every other state. It's under-resourced, under-financed, unappreciated. You've got all these funds available. You know, make the 3% that was projected a reality and make it move forward. You know, nobody wants to see government fail at this work. And none of us, to be honest, I've seen too many people die. And it's we got to do better. We can do better.
Annie writes to say, another awesome show on connections and a book recommendation for the audience, Dope Sick by Beth Macy.
Yep.
Which I've heard a lot of experts recommend there. Robert Kent, president of Kent Strategic Advisors and former general counsel for the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Please stay in touch. Be back with us the next time we need to talk about this, which is going to be soon, Robert. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jennifer Farringer, director of DePaul's National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence for the Rochester area. Thank you very much. The website where people can learn more, real quick.
NCADD-RA.org.
Thank you for being here. More connections coming up.